This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. October 1st will mark 2 years since a single gunman shot and killed 58 people at the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival in Las Vegas. More than 850 people were injured, nearly half from gunfire or shrapnel. The shootings occurred less than a week before the Las Vegas Golden Knights were to begin their inaugural season in the NHL. And in some ways, what happened next was a story of recovery, community, and hockey. Reporter Susan Vallett has our story. And just a note before we get started, this piece is going to contain descriptions of what it was like to be in the crowd during the shootings, as well as audio taken from YouTube videos and law enforcement recordings. Listener discretion is most definitely advised.
Sometimes you can find community in the least likely of places.
I had been here 10 years, and I had a pretty good grasp of Vegas, but even I underestimated how much togetherness and how much community there was here.
That's Jesse Granger, who covers Vegas hockey for the sports news website The Athletic. He was also among the first reporters on the scene of the Harvest Festival shooting.
Everyone outside of Vegas sees it as the Strip and hotels and clubs and all that and pools. Like, I feel like I didn't even give the city enough credit. And after that, it completely changed the way I viewed Vegas.
But for many in Vegas, the events of that day and the weeks and months after changed the way they looked at a sport. Hockey. 27-year-old Anthony Raboni grew up with the sport. His dad brought his love of the game with him from L.A.
He's always been a big Kings fan, so when we grew up, especially when we started playing hockey, we grew up watching the Kings play all the time. Luke Robitaille, all those guys. Our neighborhood was half the hockey community at the time, I felt like, because a lot of the kids that grew up in our little area are the ones who all went and started playing at the same time. But you go to school and tell people you played hockey, and they'd kind of give you a weird look.
Anthony's older brother, Nick, went to UNLV and played for the Rebels roller hockey team. Anthony joined him for the 2011-2012 season.
Even playing for UNLV, you know, for a long time, people would be like, oh, we have a hockey team? I'm like, yeah, we got a hockey team. Like, we're pretty decent.
A few years later, Nick signed on as a coach for UNLV's men's ice hockey team. Hockey was growing in Vegas.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
In June of 2016, NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman announced that the Las Vegas Golden Knights were coming to town. Of course, hockey fans booed him.
No, no, keep the booing. That proves you're now an NHL city.
The NHL had arrived. For the Vegas hockey community, the excitement was like Christmas morning. But while the Golden Knights were preparing to play their first regular season game, Las Vegas was hosting the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival, a 3-day party featuring country artists in an open field at the south end of the Vegas Strip. Nick and Anthony and some of their childhood hockey friends decided to attend on Sunday, the final night of the festival.
So I went and played my men's league game on Sunday, like I always do, and then afterwards I actually zipped down there as fast as I could.
Anthony took the day off from his job as a paramedic, but he also had plans for before the concert.
Actually, I had actually skipped our Sunday night league game that night to go to the Golden Knights preseason game against the Sharks. So he went and played in our hockey game. I went to the Golden Knights game. The plan was to meet up around 8:30, 9 o'clock to catch the last two acts of the concert together. I was just lucky that we actually got to meet up because there's no real good cell service there, and it was kind of trying to figure out where everyone was at. By the time we all got together, it was the end of Jake Owen's set.
It was kind of like towards the end of the concert, obviously. Jake Owen was second to last to perform, and Jason Aldean was the last and final one. You just hear like two loud like bangs. It was like 1-2. And then it kind of stopped, and then you hear like a consistent barrage of what essentially is gunfire. Yes, you heard I was put on to. But at the time, you're never thinking like, okay, I'm getting shot at a concert. You know, we've definitely shot guns in our lives plenty of times, but I think it's different when you're hearing it from that, from how far that is. So you're still not really sure what it is. Maybe it's a blown speaker or something. And you crouch down, and everybody's crouching down, and then the music stops, and you're like, okay, something's up. And then it stopped for a second, and all of a sudden it goes again, and probably the second time around when it goes again.
Get down.
You know, I feel like somebody just smashes me in the chest with a sledgehammer. I crouch down and still not thinking I was shot with a bullet. But then blood started coming out of my nose and my mouth. And then I looked down and, you know, I got a hole in my chest. And my brother's there, thank God. And my buddy, our buddy Billy, who's also a paramedic.
I heard someone say I got hit. And I look over my right shoulder and I see my brother spitting up blood. And that kind of, you know, turned it into like, okay, we're getting shot at. And my brother's been shot and we got to get the hell out of here.
You know, they both grab me and, you know, we just start running just like everybody else starts running. And it's just chaos. You know, I got one hand around my brother, one hand around Billy. And, we, you know, we're running as fast as I can go, which isn't too fast.
And so we started heading east out of the concert venue. And at that point, I was like, oh, crap, Danielle.
That's Anthony's girlfriend who was with him at the concert.
And I looked up and luckily they were running right in front of us. And that's what I told our friend Emmanuel, who's he's in the Army. And I trusted him with her life, and I was just like, hey, man, you got to take her, go that way, go to the exit and get her out. So yeah, we ran outside the east gate of the concert venue. We saw where Nick was shot at that point. He didn't have an exit wound. He just kind of had an entrance right here above his left pec, right in the spot where your lung would be at. So that kind of got me nervous with his breathing and the blood coming out. So immediately I was like, all right, well, he needs to go to the hospital. It's the only thing that's going to save him.
You know, then we get to a cop car.
And we kind of placed Nick down behind the cop car. And I remember asking the cop, said, hey, man, we got to get my brother to hospital right now. He's been shot. And he's like, I can't do that. You know, I mean, he's hunkered down behind his car with his AR out.
Cops are, they're, you know, just as kind of shell-shocked as everyone. They're just telling people to run and get out, go this way or that way.
Get out of here. There's gunshots coming from over there. Go that way. Go that way.
I kind of realized, like, hey, we're on our own for this one. I looked at Billy and I said, hey, dude, we're going to steal this cop car. So we started wrenching on the door handle, and of course it's locked. And then a few yards down the way, another cop was like right down there looking at us trying to steal a cop car. So I asked him if he had a first aid kit. He had kind of like that Walmart first aid kit with Band-Aids and Neosporin in it. And we took the plastic off of it and made what's called like an occlusive dressing.
And then we ran further backwards onto a side street. And then that's when, you know, I was sitting down and we were waiting for ambulance to come.
Loads and loads of people who had been shot started to kind of flood to where we were at. And he was shot in the first minute, and it went on for about 10 to 12 minutes. So, I mean, a lot of people continued to get shot. And at that point, when Nick was kind of stable, Billy kind of was able to sit there and stay with Nick, keep an eye on Nick, and I just kind of started to see what other people I could help. Originally, my plan is, you know, that's my brother. He's getting on the first ambulance that shows up. Whereas that first ambulance is coming down the street, felt like a lifetime. Right as that's happening, a guy who had been shot in the neck and he's bleeding out pretty bad, I was like, that guy needs to get on this ambulance. And luckily I saw a couple ambulances coming behind that.
Nick got into the second ambulance.
I didn't even get to say bye to him. I mean, he was in the back of that ambulance and I was able to peek through that window and I saw him back there sitting on the bench seat. And I just saw the medic and I just said, hey, where are you going? He said, Sunrise. I said, perfect. And I mean, that was it. Like, that was all I could do. And I just prayed that wasn't the last time I saw him.
Anthony and Billy stayed behind as first responders, helping out at the scene for about an hour and a half.
At that point, we're like, okay, well, we need to find a way to get to the hospital. There's not going to be any Ubers or anything around here. Like, how the hell are we going to get back?
Anthony and Billy made their way to the Tropicana, where they were pushed inside as rumors swirled about more shooters.
Control 374, I got medics reporting that they're getting shot at in the Tropicana.
Anthony and Billy were moved into a hallway while police tried to figure out what was going on.
Control 656, we have reports of shots fired from the Tropicana Hotel.
D22, we are at the Tropicana. There is no shots fired here.
Finally, they said, hey, there's someone on the fifth floor who's been shot in the head. We need some people to come up there and help us. So I said, raised my hand right away. I said, Billy, let's go. This is our way out. The guy he'd been shot in the head, but it didn't really penetrate the skull or anything. It just kind of wrapped around his forehead. He was super lucky, but he still didn't go to the hospital. So we basically helped him down to the valet where an ambulance was at. I remember talking to the one EMT, and he said, oh, we're going to go to UMC. And I was like, oh. I was like, no, you're going to go Sunrise. I was like, and we're going to go with you.
The ambulance brought Anthony and Billy to the emergency room at Sunrise.
Basically, when we first got there, they said, hey, you can't come back here. You can't come back to the emergency room. I said, fair enough. And I walked down the waiting room, and that's where a lot of our family and friends were, so I got to give my mom and dad a hug and a kiss. And then I said, all right, well, I'm going to go find my brother.
Anthony had done some of his training at this hospital.
So I knew the door code, and I was able to kind of sneak into the emergency room. It was like a scene from, I don't know if you've ever seen Pearl Harbor, when they have the nurses running around when Pearl Harbor's being bombed and there's blood everywhere and doctors and nurses running everywhere and screaming, and it's like that.
Finally, Anthony found someone who knew where his brother was.
He was already intubated, and he was actually not doing very well at that point. I don't think he even knows how critical he was, but his blood pressure was about 70 over 40, which I don't know if you know how low that is, but that's a pretty bad sign. And I remember them kind of ripping in his chest, trying to get a chest tube in. And, you know, it's kind of sometimes where ignorance is bliss, but I wasn't ignorant because I work in that field. So I kind of knew where he was at, and it was a little frightening.
Anthony went back to the waiting room and sat with his family for 3 grueling hours.
You see families get called up, and then they go sit back down. Then you get another family get called up, and that whole family starts to break down and cry. And it's like, all right, well, their loved one passed. And they call another, and you're like, well, which one am I going to be?
But before his family's name was called, Anthony's phone rang. It was Nick's doctor, letting Anthony know that his brother was going to be okay. The bullet hadn't pierced Nick's lung, but doctors had to cut open Nick's rib cage to find the bullet, and there was a lot of internal damage. Nick had been put in a medically induced coma.
I was in the coma for essentially that night and all the next day because I couldn't breathe on my own. So they had that breathing tube in for like, you know, a day and a half. And then I woke up and it was like October 3rd.
Doctors told Nick that being in good shape, in part from playing hockey, had helped him survive the shooting.
You have like very mixed emotions because you don't know who's alive, who's dead. Like why it happened, what happened, and now I'm just seeing like newspaper articles with my face on it and name on it, you know, and I'm just like kind of like irritated because I just didn't want any of that. Like I just wanted to like figure out what happened and then just be alone for a little bit just to collect my thoughts and everything.
While Nick recovered in the hospital, the Vegas community rallied and the city's brand new NHL team joined in. Here's reporter Jesse Granger again.
I went with the Golden Knights players to Metro headquarters, where it was like 2 days after the shooting, and there were officers there that had been working nonstop since the shooting happened, and they're exhausted, and they've just been dealing with horrifying things for the last 2 days, and it just kind of lightened their day a little bit. These players had reached out to the team and said, like, what can we do? We'll do anything we possibly can. And this is the week before the regular season opener in Dallas. They're preparing for the first game in franchise history, and that was what they were doing that week.
Nick would stream his UNLV games from his hospital room, taking notes to give to the team. And his buddies came to watch the opening game of the inaugural Golden Knights season.
It was actually 1-0, and the Knights scored late to tie it up, really late.
And the first goal in Golden Knights history ties the game.
I was in that room with 7 or 8 guys that I grew up playing hockey with. And, you know, I'd watched tons of games with them in the past before, and we'd never all cheered when one team scored.
But this time, when the Knights scored, Nick says everyone in the hospital room cheered.
And I thought that was so strange. I just remember vividly looking around, and I was like, wow. They wanted to help this city heal, and I think they did it. It gave so many people to kind of something to cheer for, and it gave them a distraction from the hardships that everybody was still going through.
As victims were released from the hospital and life began to return to normal, Nick says the city stayed behind the Knights.
People really took grasp of the Knights, their style of play, which I think really embodies the city. It's very fast-paced, very hardworking, just like a lot of people in this city. So hockey truly brought everybody together at that time.
Jesse Granger saw the Knights' impact on the city too.
I think people, because of how screwed up our society is, people forget about tragedies too quickly and we move on to the next thing. Whereas the Golden Knights made Vegas Strong their calling card and their motto, and it ended up pulling the city together for a longer period of time, I think.
Nick Raboni was left with a scar right underneath where hockey players wear a captaincy, where doctors dug out the bullet and the shrapnel. Nick had to work on breathing and walking again. He fought to build back strength. And 7 months after he came out of a coma, Nick stepped on the ice for his first hockey game.
You don't sweat the small stuff as much. When things come up, you know, before I might get a little frustrated and take things to heart a little bit more. But now I definitely just realize that it's just, life is about the relationships you make with people, loving people, enjoying it to the best of your ability. Because when you're gone, the only thing people will remember is how you made them feel. And I realize now I catch myself a lot quicker trying to do that.
Every day, as he gets ready to head out, Nick looks at one particular letter that a family friend sent him during his recovery from the shooting. It's now up to you to take advantage of this gift, the second chance that was given to you that unfortunately 58 people will never know. Like a fortuitous bounce, God has put you in front of the net with a puck right in front of you. Don't let him down.
That's reporter Susan Ballett. Nick Raboni is starting his fourth season as a coach with the UNLV men's ice hockey team. The Las Vegas Golden Knights begin their third NHL season on Wednesday. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
You know Jonathan Van Ness as a fabulous cast member of Netflix's Queer Eye. But as a kid,
I was basically just like a geode-obsessed, stamp-collecting, rock-collecting, obsessed with gymnastics.
Jonathan Van Ness on his transformation and his new book. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know. It's been 2 years since the FBI indicted four assistant college basketball coaches, igniting what became known as the college basketball corruption scandal. This week, the NCAA made its case against Kansas, and that's where we'll start. I'm joined by the Washington Post's Jerry Brewer and by Bleacher Report's Master Tesfatsian. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
Jerry, you're up first this week.
Well, Karen, it is on, finally. I think for those of us who followed the college basketball corruption scandal through the courts, we knew that it wasn't going to be quite as big of a deal as what the NCAA did about the information that the FBI had learned. And so now the NCAA is going after a big fish. They're going after the Kansas Jayhawks. They have sent them their notice of allegations, which includes three level one violations, a charge of lack of institutional control, which is one of the more serious things that the NCAA can levy, and then the new head coach responsibility charge against Hall of Famer Bill Self. Kansas is kind of setting up what could be a long legal battle, but if the NCAA is not overstepping, this could be significant punishment. And it also alludes to, there's about 20 schools that were part of this FBI investigation, including Louisville, which stays in NCAA trouble, and Arizona. The question, however, is, does the NCAA, which is almost a partner with these schools because it benefits so much, do they have the stomach to punish that many programs when it could affect their bottom line?
Master, what do you think?
There's going to be a lot of teams that are going to look at the FBI investigation and view it as a one-off of what has constantly been a continuous problem within the NCAA, which is obviously exploiting college athletes, not allowing them to receive the compensation that they rightfully deserve. And the loophole's constantly been by going through these shoe companies and these shoe deals or going through boosters and finding other ways to have these bag men to pay for these athletes. And now this has been exposed. I don't know what exactly the NCAA can do and how exactly it has the right to punish the Kansas schools, the Louisville schools, the Arizona schools, rightfully so, and still argue and say that college players who are seeking compensation is the biggest issue facing college athletes moving forward. I mean, it's ridiculous, and it's a system that clearly needs to be updated that they're not trying to update. Either the NCAA has to move forward with either paying athletes or allowing schools to do these things, or they're going to end up falling apart and there's going to be something else that replaces them.
I think this whole thing is going to be really interesting, in part because Kansas is clearly decided to fight. And I don't for a minute believe their assertions that Bill Self and the coaching staff didn't know that a representative of Adidas was offering players money, right? Like, but that said, I find myself wondering if the NCAA took on Kansas first because they knew Kansas would fight and they knew that this would drag on forever. And maybe they're just hoping that we'll all forget about it by the time it's resolved.
I think that they took on Kansas first because they wanted to send a message.
Mm-hmm.
They were embarrassed over the past 2 years. You kept hearing the word impotent in relation to the NCAA. And so I think they're fired up and they're motivated to show that they do have some teeth.
Yeah. All right, Master, what have you got for us?
I want to talk about the Washington football team. This team stinks. It's stunk for 20 years now. It has stunk since Dan Snyder's bought the team in 1999, and it was completely on display Monday night when the Washington football team got blown out by the Chicago Bears, and it dropped their record to 2-17 at home on Monday night games since FedEx Field opened in 1997. It's an organization that has completely struggled under Dan Snyder, and it's an organization that has sucked the energy out of the entire fan base, which was once a very prideful fan base. And I've never seen an NFL franchise go from such a fan base that had so much pride to one where you can buy tickets off Groupon now. And at some point, Dan Snyder needs to sell this team, but he will not. That is the ultimate change that needs to happen that will not ultimately.
Jerry, I'm going to assume you have some thoughts on this.
Well, Karen and Master, the first thing I look at is the birth certificate, and it says that Daniel Snyder doesn't turn 55 until November.
Wow.
He is one of the youngest owners in the NFL. At 54 years old, he could very easily own this franchise for the next 30 years. So if you think the first 20 years have been bad, just you wait until his golden anniversary and see how far things have sunk. It's incredible that, you know, as much as he's been through over 20 years of ownership, it doesn't seem like he's learning the lessons. He's one of the worst owners in professional sports, which is saying a lot. I think there's a lot of questionable ownership, but they continue to make money.
Yeah.
And when we talk about, oh, he should sell the team, that's the problem there. I mean, you're talking about a franchise that is worth almost $4 billion. And in reality, if you wanted to buy the Washington Redskins from Daniel Snyder, it would probably cost you $4.5 billion, approaching $5 billion, before he would open his eyes and decide to sell the team.
Man. You know, I think I get overwhelmed by bad headlines about this team, right? So, okay, so they lost the first three games. That happens. Okay, so they got embarrassed on Monday Night Football. Well, that definitely happens. You know, okay, so there's a guy stirring Gatorade with an unopened sleeve of cups. Well, that's really unusual, but I kind of think it's ingenious, so I'm not going to blame them for that. I mean, I know that fans in Washington expect more from this team, but it's not like they're Miami trading away all their players. Is the problem that they're actually trying to win and still losing?
That is 100% the problem. They actually continuously think every single year that they're fielding a playoff team that could make a deep run. Where unlike the Dolphins, who are taking the strategy that we've seen more and more in sports these days, where teams are trying to tank, Washington doesn't have a strategy. They're just piecing together whoever wants to come here for however much money they can pay them. And, you know, sometimes they'll make attractive signings like Landon Collins and, you know, bring in draft guys like Dwayne Haskins, who I think is someone who down the road has a lot of promise and potential to be a good starting quarterback at some point. But they continuously think they have these pieces that they can build around, and it never comes to fruition. Something happens, and players are recognized, and they do not want to go to Washington unless the bag is just ridiculous in terms of how much they're able to get in free agency.
All right, folks, I have some bad news. The Columbia Marching Band has been barred from all future athletic events. You remember the Columbia Marching Band, right? Here they are playing during halftime of a game against Yale in 2014. I could listen to that all day. So band members are not required to have any musical experience. Drummers drum on toilet seats. There are some band members that don't even have instruments. They just kind of dance around on the field. And when the band bothers to make a formation, that formation is likely to resemble the male anatomy. I mean, really, what's not to love about this group? According to reports, Columbia plans to form a new spirit organization overseen by a faculty director.
Wow.
A faculty director? Really? I mean, nothing against faculty directors, but they ruin everything. Am I right, Jerry?
Yes, they do. You know, whatever spirit organization they put together is guaranteed to stink on a level that is much worse than the Washington football team. This is a case in a university taking itself way too seriously. This Columbia band was just this great representation of counterculture.
Yeah.
And I almost feel like it was performance art in which they were just making fun of the pageantry of major college athletics.
Uh-huh.
I always looked at it that way. And so I will greatly, greatly miss them.
How about you, Master? Are you going to miss them?
I had never heard of them until before this moment. And as Jerry has proposed, that an Ivy League school taking itself way too seriously, you don't say. And this is coming from an Arizona State alum who never takes himself very seriously. I mean, this whole story is very Ivy League. I'll just say that as an outsider looking in. I come from the South in Dallas, so when I hear bands and I heard that music, that was not what I was expecting. I'm used to HBCU bands and the Battle of the Bands that you have at the Cotton Bowl Classic, which is actually going on during the state fair. And you hear bands like Southern and Grambling and Florida A&M, and you know how much pride and prestige they have. For me to hear a college band that doesn't have any sort of experience needed to join, that is, I've never heard of that before in my life. So I don't know necessarily if I will miss it, but these kids are supposed to be kids. So in that regard, yes. However, I would hope that at least they would have some sort of requirements so people can actually play music that sounds somewhat better than what I just heard.
Well, for the record, the football isn't that great either, so.
that should be a new rule, though. Like, you know, the level of your football team, the band should match it.
Oh, perfect.
I once wrote a story in college, one of the worst games I saw, and I wrote it as poorly as the game was played. There was all kinds of misspellings, and I created new words and
perfect.
Just punctuated however I wanted. That's the way the band should do it.
You never showed me that clip when you were mentoring me.
No.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been the Washington Post's Jerry Brewer and Bleacher Report's Master Tesfatsian. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you like what you hear on Only a Game, please help us spread the word. Leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen, and help your friends find our show. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce, and don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Fall movies are about to heat up, and Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR has you covered. We'll tell you whether some of the big films on the way are as good as you're hoping they are, and we'll help build a list of gems you can uncover for yourself. Start your Oscars prep early with Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, comedian Gary Goldman on football, depression, and two coaches called the Jetsons. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen. Jetson! You're fired!
In a doubleheader on Tuesday, the Washington Nationals eliminated the Philadelphia Phillies and former Nationals star Bryce Harper from the postseason and clinched a wild card berth despite having started their season 19-31. Pretty good day for the Phillies, huh?
Yeah, it was Philadelphia fans will take it with their usual equanimity, I'm sure. The Nationals were a very, very good baseball team from the start of the season. They just didn't win. They're healthy now. You know, they've got Max Scherzer ready to pitch the wild card single elimination game. This is a great story, but it's also not a surprising one.
Yeah. Well, Harper has been subjected to boos at home and away since leaving Washington to accept a $330 million contract with the Phillies. But he says the heckling he endured at that doubleheader in D.C. crossed the line and that he's looking forward to returning to Philadelphia. How bad must it have been for him to pine for the city that booed Santa Claus?
Wait, I was going to say, wait a minute. He's waiting for the warm embrace of the Philadelphia Phillies fans?
Who also boo him.
Oh, yeah. $300 million to booing comes with the territory. I have no idea what was said to him, but I do think it's kind of ironic that he wants to go back to Philadelphia to feel loved.
The Yankees honored C.C. Sabathia in his last regular season game at Yankee Stadium. According to ESPN, he was, quote, presented with art portraying his accomplishments and a 10-day vacation to Japan. What, no chair made out of baseball bats?
Yeah, this is actually a classy thing. I don't know what his connection to Japan is, but probably he wanted to go there his whole life, and they're going to send him. He's had an interesting career. People were waiting for him to break down entirely for what seems like 30 years now. And yet he went to New York, he pitched extraordinarily well, and you know he's a presence that's going to be missed down there.
Going into the fourth week of the NFL season, the Miami Dolphins have been outscored 133-16, allowing 18 touchdowns while only scoring one. Definitely tanking, right?
Oh, no question. I mean, I didn't think it was quite this easy to tank in the NFL. Because if you tank in the NFL, you really get hurt. But they're doing a tremendous job of it. I mean, that is the worst defensive team I think I've ever seen in the NFL.
I feel like we need to define tanking here because the defense is always the players and coaches are doing everything they can to win, which is absolutely true. Meanwhile, the front office has traded away so much talent. ESPN's Football Power Index projects that the team will have a 76.6% chance of having the first pick in the 2020 draft. I hope it's worth it.
Yeah, I hope it was too, especially considering that Laremy Tunsil and Minka Fitzpatrick, two people that they have traded away, are having terrific seasons elsewhere. This only emphasizes the fact that what the Miami Dolphins are doing this year is a 16-week exercise in consumer fraud.
Charlie, we do not usually pay attention to football games played at the Maine Maritime Academy, but this is an exception. Last Saturday, a referee was struck in the head by something shot out of a cannon during a game. That's not how these things are supposed to work, right?
No. You know, it wasn't loaded with a cannonball, thank God.
You think?
Because then you've got some sort of Civil War decapitation thing going. You know, make sure, you know, when you fire off your cannon, make sure nobody's standing in front of it. That seems like a fairly safe
rule. One.
Yeah.
You would think they would know that at the Maritime Academy. But yeah, so we should say this cannon was brought by an alum, and the school has now made a policy that alumni will no longer be allowed to bring their own cannons to games. Good move?
No cannon policy. Something we didn't anticipate having to talk about, but there we are. No artillery allowed.
And finally, Charlie, I'd like to introduce you to Philadelphia resident and former firefighter Hakeem Law. When a fire broke out in a three-story building, Law helped catch a woman and child who had been thrown from a window. And here's how he described it to a reporter on the scene.
We was catching them, unlike Aguilar and his mishaps. I like to put that out there.
Explain this, please.
Well, it's very plain that the entire world is a sports radio show now. And these are the fans, by the way, that Bryce Harper wants to go back to.
Well, Nelson Aguilar is a wide receiver for the Philadelphia Eagles. He has been struggling to hold on to the ball, but he responded by this in a pretty classy way. He's offering Law tickets to a game. Law says he'll take the tickets, but he stands by his criticism.
And he's going to boo Nelson Aguilar, I guarantee you.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the forthcoming Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week here at Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
couple of weeks ago on this very program, Jason Gay explained that there's nothing more boring than talk of a certain activity.
Have you ever listened to somebody talk about his or her fantasy football team? It's like listening to someone talk about their cat, but worse.
I tend to agree, but we think we've found the one fantasy football story that will hold your attention. It involves baseball, an undisclosed amount of money, and a secret airplane flight. Only a game's Martin Kessler has the story.
Ben Zosmer was 11 years old when he figured out what he wanted to do with his life. It was 2004, and Ben and his dad were on a road trip from Philadelphia to Fenway Park in Boston.
I don't recall if it was at the library or maybe we ordered it, but we got the audiobook of Moneyball.
As they set out on the six-hour drive, Ben and his dad started listening to a narrator reading Michael Lewis's recent book.
I wrote this book because I fell in love with the story. The story concerned a small group of undervalued professional baseball players and executives.
And this would have been back when you probably had to, you know, that's the end of disc one, turn over and put in disc two.
Yes, that was my job because my dad was the one driving, seeing as I was 11 years old.
That's good. I think that makes sense.
Yeah, good division of labor.
How did one of the poorest teams in baseball, the Oakland Athletics, win so many games?
Michael Lewis was the first one to expose how a few front offices were starting to use mathematical models in their decision-making process. And as a young child, it was revolutionary. This idea that someone like me, who loved numbers but couldn't hit or pitch or catch, could have some place in the game of baseball that I loved was an extraordinary thought.
Like any good bond trader, he loves making decisions.
The description of Billy Bean sitting there in the draft room.
He looks up at the names of the players on the whiteboard and listens to the speakerphone crackle.
Seemed to 11-year-old me like the most exciting scene ever.
Each time a team rolls the dice on a high school player, Billy punches his fist in the air.
By the time Ben Zosmer and his dad arrived back in Philadelphia, Ben had decided he wanted to work in baseball. And he did plenty to make that a reality. In high school, he interned with the hometown Phillies. He went to Harvard, where he studied applied math and computer science. Full disclosure, I first met Ben in college when we were both covering the men's basketball team. Him for the college radio station, me for the student newspaper. After his freshman year, Ben interned at baseballreference.com. He was working to earn himself a seat at the table in an MLB draft room. Little did he know, he was also preparing himself for a very different type of draft. Last fall, about a decade and a half after Ben went on that road trip with his dad, Los Angeles Dodgers third baseman Justin Turner and Director of Athletic Development and Performance Science Brandon McDaniel had a problem.
Yeah, me and Brandon have had a notorious record for slow starts and injuries.
That's Justin Turner. And when he's talking about slow starts, he's not referring to his performance on the baseball field.
Here's a payoff. Turner smashes another. He's got a three home run game.
In 2017, Justin was an all-star and the NLCS MVP. He's got a bushy red beard and a playful personality. And he's been one of the leaders of a Dodgers team that's reached the World Series the last two seasons. When Justin says slow starts, he's talking about the team he and Brandon McDaniel share in the Los Angeles Dodgers Fantasy Football League.
It seems as if we always end up with one of the better teams by the time the playoffs roll around. However, we usually fall a game short of making the playoffs.
The Dodgers take fantasy football seriously. According to the LA Times, a Dodgers player once orchestrated a fantasy football trade during batting practice before a playoff game.
It's like a very big deal.
That's Brandon McDaniel.
Obviously, a lot of type A personalities around here that are very competitive.
There's a decent prize at stake at the end of the year, and it makes for great trash talk.
You mentioned the prize. Could you give me a sense of how much is at stake here?
I'm not going to get into that, but it's worth it.
Now, just for context, 3 years ago, Justin Turner signed a $64 million contract. And he told me the worst part of missing the fantasy football playoffs is losing a shot at that cash prize. So you can imagine what worth it means. The league is made up of 12 teams, most owned by Dodgers players. One is run by the Dodgers clubhouse attendants, guys who handle equipment and stuff like that. But the league has also featured entrants from the Dodgers front office.
What those front office guys do for a living is put together teams and select players. So, you know, there's definitely some trash-talking advantages if you can take those guys down and be better than them at their job.
Except in 2015, 16, and 17, Brandon and Justin and the rest of the Dodgers players were certainly not better than then-Dodgers general manager Farhan Zaidi. Farhan won 3 straight championships, a stunning accomplishment in an endeavor involving so much chance. Justin and Brandon, meanwhile, missed the postseason all 3 years.
I'm not going to say we were chasing Farhan. We were just trying to get in the playoffs.
Justin and Brandon needed some help. Then, right around the time the 2018 fantasy football season was starting up, Brandon got promoted from his job as strength and conditioning coach to director of athletic development and performance science. And that's when he met one of the Dodgers' young analysts, Ben Zosmer, who'd graduated from Harvard in 2015 and landed in the team's research and development office.
That's the heavy statistical side of the organization.
Ben's job consisted almost entirely of working with the Dodgers' other analysts. He was pretty separate from the players, besides occasionally passing them in the hall. But that was all about to change, because when Ben met Brandon McDaniel, they started talking about fantasy football.
Ben was telling me about this like league that he was in, and he was just babbling off all kinds of fantasy football stuff.
Brandon got an idea.
He sends me a text and says, come to the locker room.
Wow. And what's going through your head?
Why does Brandon McDaniel want me to come to the locker room? So I went down, and there he was with Justin Turner.
Justin Turner, all-star, NLCS MVP. In Ben's 3-plus years with the organization, they'd never met.
Well, I introduced myself to Justin Turner. Very nice guy. We got to know each other pretty quickly. We started talking fantasy football, and they explained that they wanted me to help out with their fantasy football prep.
My first impression was like, wow, we have a real advantage here.
Kind of seemed like a match made in heaven.
At first, Ben figured Justin and Brandon just wanted to chat about some potential draft picks. But it turned out they had more in mind. Much more. They wanted Ben at the table at the fantasy football draft. There was one small problem. The draft was going to be held at star pitcher Clayton Kershaw's home in Texas while the Dodgers were on a road trip. Ben, in his role with the research and development department, didn't travel to away games. But Justin and Brandon had a plan.
They said, all right, we're going to fly you to Dallas. The draft is next week. And I laughed because I assumed they were joking. And then they made it clear, no, they were in fact serious, and I was expected in Dallas shortly.
In the week leading up to the draft, Ben pulled double duty. During the day, he did his job trying to help the Dodgers win the World Series. At night, he'd do football research and chat with Brandon and Justin to prepare for the fantasy draft in Texas.
Instead of joining on the team plane, I took a separate flight from Los Angeles to Dallas.
And they bought you these tickets?
Yes, they were kind enough to at least cover the cost of travel.
Did you get to at least fly first class, too?
It was not first class,
okay. But
it was still a very nice flight. No complaints.
Ben checked into his room at the team hotel. Then he Ubered with Justin and Brandon to Clayton Kershaw's house. Ben's introduction to the 3-time Cy Young winner was captured on camera by Sportsnet LA for a show called Backstage Dodgers.
Secret weapon?
Ben. Hi, Clayton. Ben.
Hey, what's up, man?
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, come on in.
What's up, dude?
It was just surreal. Honestly, if the crew for Backstage Dodgers hadn't been filming this, I might not have even believed that it happened.
Did you sneak on a plane or something? Or how'd they, or you fly separate?
They flew me in separate.
Yeah. No.
I was told if I saw him in the hotel, I'd get down on the floor.
But Ben had to stay focused. After all, he had an important job to do. When the draft began, he had his laptop out. Justin Turner and Brandon McDaniel flanked him on either side, peering over his shoulder at the computer. Coming out of the draft, the trio felt good. Leonard Fournette was the team's top running back. But then, early in the season...
All right, finally, Leonard Fournette will be out indefinitely after aggravating his already injured hamstring. Fournette.
When the playoffs came around, Justin and Brandon were once again on the outside looking in. They fell short by a single game. So after that season, were you a little worried about your job security in this side hustle?
Well, from the end of the season, Justin and Brandon were saying things with the phrase next year, implying to me that I at least got one more year to give it a shot.
Justin Turner doesn't blame his analytics department for last year's finish.
No, we just got unlucky.
So for this year's edition of the Los Angeles Dodgers Fantasy Football League, Ben Zosmer was back in the draft room with Justin Turner and Brandon McDaniel. This time, Ben didn't have to take a separate flight or sneak around any hotel hallways. Ben recently moved over to the baseball operations department. He still works primarily with numbers, but now he interacts with the Dodgers players in non-fantasy football settings and sometimes travels with the team on road trips. And in the weeks leading up to this year's draft, he says players and coaches came up to him to talk about fantasy football.
Because now I guess I'm fully a part of the league.
I myself still have to pinch myself when I get to sit there at the table with the Los Angeles Dodgers playing fantasy football.
And what's your relationship like with Justin Turner at this point? Are you guys friends now, would you say?
So we're definitely fantasy co-owners. He's a really great guy, and we certainly enjoy talking to each other about fantasy.
Brandon McDaniel says he doesn't expect the three of them to go on triple dates anytime soon. But he says that he, Ben, and Justin Turner, or JT, enjoy being around each other. And they do have a group text message.
Just the other night, we were on a text thread, and JT asked me to send him a workout real quick before the off day. And I wrote on there, said, "Hey, Ben, you got to do this one too." Just giving Ben a little bit of crap because he works out with us every once in a while in the weight room.
The message was filled with abbreviations for different workouts. Ben replied,
"Yeah, I'll do it as soon as you can tell me what any of this stuff means."
Is it possible that this fantasy football collaboration will actually help the Dodgers on the baseball field by bringing together players and stat heads? Justin Turner says he's always been a fan of analytics. Still, he says it doesn't hurt to get to know one of the guys behind the numbers.
You know, put a face to the information that I'm getting has been pretty cool.
Has it improved your math skills at all?
No, I don't think I'm any better at math, but you kind of seen through a lens of how he views things in a different sport. And so it kind of helps you understand the stuff they're putting together for us on the baseball field.
And 15 years after he first read Moneyball, Ben Zosmer can now confirm that being in the room for the MLB draft is just as exciting as it seemed in the book.
Every morning I drive into Chavez Ravine at Dodger Stadium and still think, oh my gosh, I get to go to work at a baseball stadium. It's a pretty wonderful feeling.
I guess the only thing you need now is a World Series.
I'll take a World Series. I'll take a fantasy football championship. If I had to pick one, without a doubt, it's the World Series, but both would be pretty nice.
That story came to us from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. The Los Angeles Dodgers will enter the playoffs with the National League's best record. More importantly, heading into the weekend, the fantasy football team run by Justin Turner, Brandon McDaniel, and Ben Zosmer has a 2-1 record. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Jonathan Chang. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.